Now we're back on. I wanted to, since you were bringing up the pew and just the situation there, as well as since the copy of the NIH grant application gave me is dated from around the same time, and I'm not going to play devil's advocate because, in a sense, they already have, the reviewers. There seems to be a question about, oh, God, here comes another thing about protein kinase C, and isn't this stuff everywhere? And, you know, it reacts with everything, and what's this, you know, is this going to work? I mean, there seems to be this issue, and I think you've kind of brought it up that even with you, there's, you know, you saw that this could really, really pay off and not make you a famous person pay off, but answering some basic questions about biology.
Well, I mean, actually, you touched at it in a very sort of very specific way in terms of PKC, with because that was our initial connection to sphingolipids. But in my mind, I never thought of sphingolipids as peculiarly associated with PKC. Mm-hmm. I thought of that as a lead into starting to examine sphingolipids. And again, I mean, to size up the Pew evaluation, I think that came as a wonderful a boost of morale that you could still do innovative research and carve a new area or attack a new area.
And I think where the NIH is saying, okay, slow down, put the... there's some mention of, and you don't have this incredibly detailed thing of what you're going to be doing every minute for the next 5 years because this is already risky.
Yeah.
And somebody says, you know, this is somebody who's just starting out, and don't they, you know, it's almost like they're suggesting you're arrogant. Yeah. Whereas I think the reaction among people at the Pew was, boy, this is what we're after some of the time, and this is where we're going to see what, you know, this is where we throw some money at it and don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, that, again, maybe we can come back to that, but I think this is how science should be funded, to encourage excellence and innovation and not in the immediate results. You know, but that maybe we can come back to the policies
that's certainly a major
of science
issue,
later.
Even if Bernardine is no longer there.
Oh, yeah, it's still a major issue.
Yeah.
And the Pew money had practical effects that went beyond the money. One was the meetings. The annual meetings were always mind-boggling because it showed me that I wasn't alone. And there were 19 people from each in my year and 60 other people. Mm-hmm. Each, you know, were embarking on a new story with new approaches, new ideas. And a lot of it was way out, you know, left field for me in terms of a lot of biology, even some botany. And but it showed me that, you know, if you sit back and think, hey, how can we be innovative here? You can be. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to be innovative about. And that has been very helpful to me, because if I wanted to be innovative on my own and went through just the regular NIH channel and whatnot, that with the years, it's becoming more and more coercing in terms of not being innovative. Mm-hmm. And the Pew is like a breath of fresh air. My idioms are terrible, so you must correct me when actually, they got me in trouble many times, but just, you know, misplacing an off into an oven, you could irritate on and in, and people can get...
I found that very articulate people when English is at the... actually are doing wonderful things with the language. No, I actually enjoy them, and I think
so. But I do commit a lot of errors in either idioms or whatever.
Well, I hope.
But so the Pew was really fascinating from those aspects. It was also important practically, because I think my chairman, Joe Greenfield, head of medicine at Duke, who was very supportive from day one, he more trusted me rather than at a sort of a gut level feeling from knowing about what I did and how people who were very close to me, like Bob Bell and Jim Nidell, viewed my work and abilities, rather than from the point of view saying, hey, he solved this problem this way, so he's good, or from the point of view of, well, we really need someone doing this kind of work in our department. So with that kind of trust, you know, getting...
It was a personal thing. In other words, what you're saying, I mean, even if he wasn't personally close to you, what it was,
he wasn't
could have been doing, you know, God knows what.
But and he wasn't close to my science either.
Right.
So it was very good to have this kind of outside consolidation of his trust, you know, his belief that,
when you've got somebody on your side kind of taking the plunge with you or whatever.
When it's a vote of confidence from the pew that, this guy was chosen among, you know, a very competitive group by a very prestigious group. So he's also, what I thought about him must have been good. That was helpful. I mean, these kind of attitudes and support are very essential to survive. So that's where the Pew came in. A year later or a couple of years later, I got an American Heart established investigatorship. That was another vote. I mean, these are not, I mean, that definitely wasn't important for the dollars, again, as much as the vote of confidence to get from, you know, the outside peers.
And this one now, I'm almost afraid to pronounce
it. The Mallinckrodt.
Mallinckrodt.
Yeah, that was really something, because that's one person.
Is that Box 2 or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the only 2. That's great.
And that's one person a year chosen.
Oh, really? Okay. So do you mind? I mean, we can spend a couple of minutes, since we're talking funding or how these the day-to-day and practical aspects of survival affect doing science.
Well, the Mallinckrodt...
They just call you up and say you win, or you lobby
for it? No, they invite a nominee from several institutions. One nominee per institution from several institutions. And they ask them to submit...
Is it the same institutions every year? They just pick...
I think different institutions, different years. There may be a few that sort of... Like the Pew does. I mean, I don't think it's not as extensive. I mean, the pool is not anywhere as extensive.
The Pew's criterion is $17 million in NIH funding at an institution.
Okay.
And if there's like twice that, or there's the medical center plus the, then there's allowed 2 people.
So, I really don't know the mechanics of the Mallinckrodt, but they invite several, and then they have 5 who go to St. Louis to interview for personal interviews with a group of lay people. A lawyer and a businessman. Well, there was a radiologist, I think, but really no basic scientist.
And these, and who's funding this? I mean,
the Mallinckrodt Foundation, which is
a
foundation based on, I think, the Mallinckrodt Company.
And that's anything to do biomedical?
Chemical reagents, biochemical, biomedical supplies. And it was fascinating because I had to describe my research and interact with these people, 4 or 5 people, over an hour, describing my work in very simple, not necessarily simple, but be able to articulate
like you're
it.
Doing here.
No. I mean, you've read some of my work.
Okay.
You've met other scientists. Those people who haven't done science haven't read science either. Okay. So it was really an experience, and I prepared for that a little bit, a few hours, mostly with my wife. In terms of how can I come across to those, and I think I did. We had a very lively discussion.
I don't know if your wife would have been the best.
really. So
as a confidant, she would have been. But I mean,
I was starting out from a very technical, you know, where you could easily lose the people. You lose the forest because of the trees, and you know. But I think starting at sort of a common ground, finding the common ground. We ended up with a very lively discussion about the science. So it was really intriguing. So one can be effective in communicating excitement about science to the lay audience if you can discover the common ground. Again, that was another vote of confidence. My experience with NIH has been much less of the review process at NIH is very rigorous, but again, it's becoming more exacting and playing it very, very safe, and that's at the sacrifice of any leeway in innovativeness. I mean, you can't go in with a grant and say, hey, I'm interested in that, I want to look how... You have to lay it out, you know, in almost excruciating detail in terms of... Well, again, I don't know if we're going to come back to that later or now is the time to...
Why don't we do that now? Well, I mean, there's a few more things
about your
research. Because
we sort of took off from how we build our research problems.
It's
actually
amazingly coherent and will be, I think. And don't worry, let's continue with the NIH since it's...
Well, I mean, biomedical research is in a big mess now, and it's in a very... It's in jeopardy because from the way I see it, the scaffold, the backbone to biomedical research in this nation is the R01 given out by NIH, the individual research proposal. And that's the one that's been taking a beating year after year for a number of factors. First, the research budget has grown, but the government, the NIH has grown, but at a slow pace. And number two is the government is mandating more and more how a lot of that research money is being spent. That is being subject to a lot of lobbying groups. I think the AIDS lobby has been very effective in pouring in a lot of money into AIDS research, which is fine. Which you need. I mean, if you want to make progress on a specific disease, you need to fund until saturation, so that you fund a lot of garbage, but you never know when the real insight comes from what lab doing what at what time. So that's fine. But it has also opened up the eyes of many other groups that, hey, breast cancer. We want to fund breast cancer.
A very interesting article or series of pieces in Science recently, too, about that. And the woman who, and she talks quite openly about tactics.
People are starting to talk about tactics and lobbying efforts, which is fine. I mean, but the way I would like to see it is that if those monies come in on top of what's in the, the potty.
The pot, right.
The pot. Too many children.
Too many children.
Too many children. Jeez, what a goof! What a guy.
No.
But it's not happening that way. So that's where. What's giving? What's giving is the R01, and my prediction is there's going to be more and more of people with prostate cancer. The older men are going to lobby for prostate cancer research.
They may not have to lobby the Senate. Be full of them themselves, right?
Yeah.
And just
any group that can get an audience with the Senate is going to make an effective case. Train of thought. So that's one problem is a lot of money is now being mandated, cancer centers. We have a cancer center here that gets a budget of $2.5 million a year, and there are dozens of those. $2.5 million a year, that's 15 to 25 R01s. That's a lot. And that's money doesn't filter much into research. That does not filter into basic research. It filters into other health issues, but not directly into basic research. So there's that problem. Another major problem is, unlike medical schools that have regulated entry into medical education, graduate schools in biomedical research have not regulated entry, either at the level of graduate admissions or at the level of junior faculty. So there is a tremendous surplus now that does not match the demand. And
that's relatively new, isn't it? I mean, it's really like there was such expansion in the field until what? God, even the end of the 70s, early 80s.
There was expansion going right on.
I also mean just the positions available and people going into the graduate school. And before, like 5 years ago, it wasn't a problem. There wasn't a flood of now unemployed.
5 years ago, there was no acute problem. Right. But I bet you if someone had sat down and ran through the calculations,
they should have
predicted a problem. Sure. Because at that time, that's when a lot of hiring was going on. New faculty and no funds. And the system was set up for plenty. When there was a lot of supply, a lot of demand created by the research dollars poured by the government and very little supply. So there was, government was supplying construction, fully funding research, and that was the mode. So departments started being created and new faculty being hired. That's still going on now. Even at Duke, as you look outside my window now, there's a new building coming up. What does that mean? New recruits, you know, creating more supply and more graduate students, because with every new recruit you need to expand your graduate training program, so that, because again, like the R1 is the backbone of biomedical research, graduate students are the backbone of individual labs. So this is more and more expansion. That was good in the 60s and 70s. It's not good now. I think, so the system is starting to crack real fast. And, you know, other errors in projection. I think the NSF made serious errors in projection that there's going to be shortage of faculty by the year 2000. They retracted that miserably last year, but I think those were very primitive, erroneous calculations. So a number of reasons, I think, have worked almost in concert at the same time to really put major force on the R01 system. And the system, again, I mean, study sections which appropriate or approve grants and rank them were designed so where peers can go in, review grants, and decide this one-third is great, this one-third is lousy, and the middle third, well, we can fund some now, give the remaining a chance, they'll come back, if they're on the right track, they'll prove themselves. So ultimately, they were funding a big percentage of funds. And you
wasn't it even like 50% at some point?
I think 50% from the first round and maybe up to 70, 80% being funded, you know, if you consider...
Of the approved.
Of the approved, right. And going back, you know, second cycle or something.
Right.
So the system was very generous and the results were phenomenal. I mean, the expansion in basic research has just been phenomenal. I should actually to distribute the blame where the blame should be distributed. The scientific community. I mean, I blame now the university administration of not realizing the new times and, you know, what are the new forces are. Congress for micromanaging and missing the point, but also the scientific community for playing the game and not making sure that even early on when things were plenty, that they make their case for what their case should be. Let me explain that. If I was a researcher in the 70s, I could be a biochemist studying E. coli. I would send a grant to NIH and preface it by saying, if we understand how E. coli do function X, we'll help understand cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get funded through the National Cancer Institute. They knew they had no interest in cancer. Their work was not going to lead in any...
Mm-hmm.
Sort of any legitimate connection to cancer, so that any independent outsider, if you're really looking at it, that's not going to tell me anything about cancer. And so they played the game. They played it as people who did the research and applied for the grants, and as people sitting on study sections funding those grants. Mm-hmm. They ignored that. They were instructed not to look at the relationship of mm-hmm. research to really the health issues directly, but just evaluate the merit, which is fine. But by playing that game, I think they forfeited.
We out there whose supposed tax money, I mean, to give, yeah. you know, to put it in the kind of the yeah. context you're doing, think that, yeah, those guys who say they're going to help cure cancer are
and
going
where
to
is,
do that.
Where are the results?
Well, yeah,
and
sure.
That's the question raised by now congressmen and people. Where are the results from that E. coli work?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the scientific community, us, the scientific community, have forfeited a lot of our input into the system.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that? Yeah, well, I mean, why is there just okay? The NCI is got the big pot of cash now, so you make this up instead of going the extra,
yeah.
going this down the straight and narrow path in the extra way, and saying, look, we want you to set up the National Science Foundation's subdivision of basic pure
exactly.
research.
Oh yeah,
and fund that. And
yes.
this is why.
Exactly.
And we'll show you why.
Exactly. I think if had so, exactly, I mean, everybody was playing the game. The congressmen, NIH, the scientists, the universities. I mean, universities. I mean, still up because to this day, my operation costs Duke probably nothing. My salary, the salary of everyone in my lab, all our research supplies, expenses are paid by my grant.
As a matter of fact, you probably bring in money.
Oh, I bring in indirect costs, right, that go into administration and overhead.
Pretty low here, huh?
They're like 50%, but that's not trivial. That's not trivial.
It's 78% someplace.
Yeah, but everybody was playing the game. And instead of the science saying, hey, science, you know, by providing the infrastructure, cancer researchers will benefit a lot. The economy will benefit a lot. We will be the leaders in biomedical research, and the economy is going to get a boost. The nation is going to get a boost because we're going to train the best minds in this country. Mm-hmm. That should have been the argument.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it occurs that something like the National Endowment for the Humanities, I mean, people are editing Latin texts written in the 14th century.
Oh, I think
they're justified. I mean,
somehow people would have justified that. I think they should have said, like exactly like you said, that would have been a very viable model to say, well, let's restructure part of NIH like NSF and fund basic research, knowing that if we understand how DNA gets clipped in E. coli, we'll have restriction enzymes. You can't foresee what's going to happen, but you could make the general case, and then you prove it by example, in retrospect, say, by understanding restriction enzymes, we have the molecular biology revolution. Sure. Cancer research will definitely benefit and has benefited from that.
Yes.
But, you see, scientists didn't make that argument.
They were too busy other things? I mean, but what? I mean, here is somebody I think of you, and actually everybody I've interviewed, they'll always say, well, I don't want to make that generalization because I can't back it up. Or, you know, I don't like to go, you know, they're very, very careful people about making statements of fact and moving from point to point. I mean, that's the currency in which
we deal with. Yeah.
Yeah. You trade off. Well, why would they just give it up and write on the, and I've seen, I mean, it's not in the 70s. I mean, I've seen grants where, you know, I know it's phony. I know it's this thing you.
And if you know, you're the taxpayer. You know,
I don't plan on getting involved that way. But I.
Well, I mean, if you're a representative of the taxpayer,
I'm kind of shocked.
And you know, I think that's where the trust has broken down. Why did they do it? I think that was the game in town. It was sanctioned by everybody. NCI was happy to have the best minds in biomedical research being funded by NCI. Mm-hmm. So they didn't mind that. The system, as I told you, was not set up to say, hey, this is not NCI material, this is pure science, let's create a pot for basic research. So, you know, those were the available funds. I think the researchers went after the dollars. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, in the big picture, you can say by pouring in the money into NCI, you did recruit the greatest minds into cancer, you know, basic research, mm-hmm. made them survive, provided the infrastructure. So to me, it's justified.
Okay.
The thing is, not making the case has discredited us. I don't think playing the game is really the evil. Mm-hmm. Is not sort of... in fact, I mean, those people that you mentioned that where it looks like it's real phony, those people are probably don't play the game well. No, I'm serious, because the game to explain the situation. Mm-hmm. I think the game does not ask you to make a phony statement that hey, my work is related to cancer research through this and this and this mm-hmm. way, because who are the reviewers? The reviewers are people or scientists. Who actually, if they smell any phony part, they're gonna discredit you a little bit.
But I've also, on tape have situations or discussions about the fact. Well, I write my NIH grant, and really, my NIH grant is three parts. There's the one part, the first third, which is I've already done this. See what I've done. This is really good. The second part is this is what I'm doing. See, it's going to pan out. It's starting to pan out. And then there's this other little part, the third part, that's kind of really, it's totally buried, okay, here's the stuff that I don't really know about. I'm really not even going to talk about it, but indeed, I'm really going to use part of my funding on that. But I'm talking about, you know...
For cancer research, to relate to cancer, is that what you're saying? Or to relate to arthritis?
And then they'll say, when I sit on my study section, I read that grant from, and it's the same written the same way, and I know exactly what's going on, and I fund it.
But see, those people are really not playing the game well. Because, you know, I sit on study sections too. And if anything, when you start pulling in those weak aims of your research, it starts sinking your proposal. I mean, the other parts must be really good to maintain it at the funding level. But if you didn't put that in, it...
Oh, I think the grant, I think the work's brilliant work, but one thing is they think they're playing a game about, for instance, not taking risk and making it look like it's going to save someone's life.
Yeah, that's... No. Okay, there are two components here in what you're saying. One about not taking risks, that's unfortunately a reality now. If you get a reviewer, and there's a lot of mediocrity now among reviewers, they cannot take risks because they can't even imagine what's going on. We are facing mediocrity in science. I want to come back to that. But the other component of your statement is to say, I'm going to save human lives with that study. I mean, I've sat on American Heart. I sit on American Heart. And somewhat, American Heart tells people, you know, you can discuss the relationship of your proposal to heart disease in a paragraph outside the proposal.
Okay.
But you see some people coming in with a specific and saying, well, I'm going to do these things in cardiac cells and heart cells and whatnot. And it's such a phony and weak part that it only sinks down the grant. So you don't have to. And what I'm saying is NIH does not ask you to make that phony claim.
For an R01 grant.
For an R01. The reviewers are asked not to look for a connection. So you will still be funded by NCI for whatever you present to NCI, without making the phony claim. So scientists weren't really, I mean, they shouldn't have been in part of the deception game. That's not a question of deception. The people who were incorporating some of that, let's call it deception, in their grants didn't have to. They were it was a misunderstanding on their part about how the process works, I think.
But the problem comes... I don't want to imply on tape that I think that there's really kind of like out-and-out deception going on, and now it's coming home to roost the payoff. And I was agreeing, however, with you or getting into this situation where once things get really tight, I mean, it's like people have just kind of waited and now the thing has fallen.
Yeah. I mean, it is fallen, but I think where scientists failed is to make their case directly to the people in Congress and funding agencies that protect the investment in basic research because it's for the benefit of the health and the economy of the nation. That is an undisputed argument, and it should have been made that way. I think universities should have said, it's still not too late because I think the scientific community has to go back and make those arguments. Because I mean, I heard in science someone claiming that no one died of general medical sciences. So we shouldn't fund the Institute of General Medical Science. I mean, to have a bureaucrat at NIH utter that sentence, even half-jokingly, is kind of very descriptive of the problem, very symptomatic of the problem. And I think the scientific community should come back and make a case for really describing the significance of what they do. That what they do is going to maintain a class, an echelon of brilliant young scientists. And that is helpful for the economy, helpful for future health discoveries and health-related research.
Well, of course, these issues go beyond just biomedical. Yeah. I mean, look at the issues surrounding like this funding of the space station and the super collider, and just the almost kind of
The problem,
it's become violent almost, and everybody's involved.
That's
and of course,
true.
It's right. The American public is engaged in it or in
really. But the problem though is you get something like with the Clinton administration, which says we want to invest in the future of the country and the areas of the strength of the country. That administration sees clearly microchips as an area where we're ahead, and we are ahead, and we should invest in that and keep training people who are brilliant in that area. But that administration doesn't see as clearly that biomedical research is equally important, probably more important as an investment, as an economic investment. You know, if you look at the pharmaceutical industry in this country, the biotechnology industry, the university industry, I mean, we're clearly in an undisputed leadership position. I mean, like with microchips, we're in a race with Japan. In biomedical research, we're in a race with no one. We're clear leaders. We export to the rest of the world our abilities and accomplishments there. I think the universities should readjust and say, the universities that want to make a commitment to biomedical research should invest now in that and say, okay, we want to keep active biomedical research programs. We're going to invest in building buildings, if that's what they need to do, in supporting programs.
Instead of expecting it to be a cash cow.
Yeah, exactly. And the government has to, I think, dissociate the funding of health-related issues where you as a taxpayer can read a proposal and say,
this is an epidemiological study about preventing,
this person is looking at how molecules interact with the HIV virus so that they get imported, or I can see the relation. But then you say, oh, this is a pure science project. That's beyond my expertise in terms of knowing whether it's going to, it's of merit or not. I'm going to let the experts decide on that. I don't need to give my stamp of approval for this particular proposal, but I understand that we should preserve and maintain this kind of science. Also, programs should come in. I think that's the last item of the equation, is programs in universities should come in and say, hey, a useful steady state for us, considering the budget limitation, is to have X young faculty coming into the system a year. That's steady state. And really try to control entry into the system so that they maintain that supply of young investigators. This way, you see, that's where, again, excellence becomes the issue here. This is where they regain excellence, because if things start to keep on deteriorating, we're going to lose the best young minds, because they're going to say, hey, there's a very great uncertainty in this career. I'm going to go into law school. And the only way to guarantee that, to overcome that, and say, if you're excellent and you give it your all, you know, with all what you got, and work in that area, you know, we're going to take care of you. You're going to be funded to do what you can, the best thing you can do, and you're going to have a decent lifestyle. Which, again, I mean, scientists could be physicians. The best scientists could be, they don't go ahead, you know.
They're not in it for the money.
Yeah, they're not in. Although, again, the social climate has tempted many to switch to more financial.
I think we're entering an era also, clearly, where the lines that seem to have been drawn, let's say, between academia and industry and an investigator's self-interest in a project, his or her reputation, the reputation of postdocs and grad students in the lab, the peer review acceptance of the work, and now starting of a biotech firm become fuzzier.
They're fuzzier, and there are a lot of contradictory directives and forces there. I mean, like government wanting to foster NIH relationships with industry, and yet, you know, NIH researchers, if they go to a company, they can't even get a bagel offered to them. You know, they can't accept a bagel. Sure. You know, it's kind of
schizophrenic right now.
It is right now. Right. But again,
that's more, I think, you know, that's a symptom of change.
It's not a so symptom much of change.
A symptom of some disease that needs to be routed out.
No, that's a symptom of change. The same with funding. It is very symptomatic of change now. However, those symptoms are sort of malignant symptoms.
Whether it can be correlated, as I said to you off tape, the Pew program itself, in and of itself, and the people behind it, and the board, and Tom Langdon and Rebecca Reimel, are perhaps, and actually they've done oral histories, you know, are
from my point of view, as equally or potentially interesting people to talk to about this, because all of a sudden in 1985, the kind of funding that you've just said on tape, and I think almost everybody has, without exception, you know, it is something sort of new and different. I mean, it's aimed at people at this one. I mean, it's very narrowly focused. Yeah. It hits every big institute. I mean, it's somebody planned this. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to know exactly why. Mm-hmm. The way that I think the selections are made are very different than most selections. It's fluid and flexible, yeah. I think. And then the HHMI, which seems to be switching from we're going to go to this place, build this building, fund these 50 guys and gals, and put them all together. And now they seem to be going around and just picking out individuals. I mean, how HHMI perceives its role. And it's also just spending more money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in Russia now.
So
there may be responses to the malignancies or something
there,
like
there
that.
There are, but again, I mean...
But it may be...
These are very important, but they're only going to make maybe a dent. Mm-hmm. They're maybe more like the equivalent of pain relievers in treating a cancer patient. Right. I mean, you need more of those. It's very good that these are a couple of things that recognize and reward excellence,
mm-hmm.
but you need it at other levels too. I mean, you may need it at more senior people to tell senior scientists, you know, there isn't nothing in the system at this point to reward a senior scientist at any level that makes a dent in the system, where you reward reward them with a Nobel Prize or a couple other major awards,
but
that doesn't make a dent in the system, because it's almost, you know, all these awards go to the top 0.05%, or that really doesn't make a dent in the system. But you almost need to reward excellence at an advanced level, where you can say, hey, you've trained a wonderful cadre of young investigators. We're going to reward you to the point of where if you do that, you're going to be rewarded. You know, with a Nobel Prize now, it's like a touch and go. You know, you could be the most wonderful, fascinating scientist and, you know, you'll never make it just because of the volume. So the Nobel Prize is really, I don't think, should be a goal, because, again, I mean, it's a...
Yeah, I don't know that it... Well, I guess I get the sense that it's like any kind of daydreaming goal, it's a goal.
But therefore, it loses its effectiveness in rewarding excellence.
No, definitely.
So you need other rewards that can touch more people and reward them for different aspects. You know, you can reward the mega labs for their productivity, but you need to reward maybe the smaller labs. Phil Majerus has trained half of the academic hematologists in this country.
I didn't hear
Philip Majerus, Majerus.
Thank you. Now I can't remember the name.
I mean, he's either trained directly or indirect. You know, people who he trained went on to train. I mean, reward someone like that. You know, maybe his body of work has been excellent, but never super outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
But his pedigree, his contribution in terms of future scientists, I think is unmatched.
Mm-hmm.
So reward that. And reward, you know, the top 10-20% mm-hmm. who do that. Reward the top 10-20% who contribute new creative thoughts to science. Mm-hmm. You know, make sure those are still, you know, those are very much needed at, mm-hmm. you know, at entry level like the Pew does, maybe at intermediate levels, at later levels.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think we need to tackle things at the root. I think obviously now the country as a nation is not ready to keep expanding the biomedical research base the same way it's been expanding in the last 20 years.
I mean, that's perhaps this kind of...
But rather than have a sort of a scientific massacre 5 years from now, you know, try to, you know...
And have these new buildings be empty or...
Oh, I mean, it's funny, like my chairman already mentions the fact that the Department of Medicine, which is going to get a lot of space in this huge building right outside the window here...
It's going to be pretty big.
He doesn't plan major recruiting into it, because he realizes now that he's not going to have the dollars for startups, for new investigators, and he's at the same time gives funding for scientists who miss one round of funding or we're going to miss more than one round of funding. So I think reality is going to sink in, and that's why I think building kind of stupid now.
Yeah, but this was probably planned, what, 7 years?
It was planned 3 years ago, two years ago. It was thought of maybe 3-4 years ago, but really planned 2 years ago. So I think the reality is going to catch up with us, but what I'm afraid of is in the process we're going to sacrifice the excellence in science. That's my concern. I'm pretty sure 10 years from now, if things continue the same way they are, let's say maintaining the same kind of funding, things were going to come back to a different steady state. We're going to see many schools bail out of the research game. They're just not going to get funded. They're not going to have the ability to support research.
And maybe we got into it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And they got, we're getting money for it.
And, from indirect cost and the prestige and whatnot. We're going to see bigger schools scale back on what they have. But what I'm afraid is, in the meantime, we're going to sacrifice excellence. We're already doing that. The message we're sending to our high school students, and I've seen it, Mike Bishop, the Nobel laureate, who came here a couple of weeks ago, spent quite a bit of his lecture to describe that. When
I was going to bring up that lecture, because I heard it in Hawaii,
I believe
it was actually was. I was disappointed in it in some aspects, but maybe we'll find that it is this, we can turn that we're getting toward the end. Because there was one question I wanted to follow up on and kind of ask.
Do you want to stop now or continue with that?
I think we can go, it's like 2 minutes, I'll just make sure I catch it.
That, in his discussions with high school students, the world has come filtered down already that, this is not the sort of career people want if they want to be creative and productive. So we're sacrificing that at that level, entry into the system. We're sacrificing excellence at the level of people already in the system who are outstanding and excellent in terms of really preventing them from being creative. I mean, I consider myself a successful scientist. The amount of time I spend in grant writing, in management, and doing things I don't care about is overwhelming. What is the time that's giving to allow for that? It's the creative time. It's the time when I can sit and read something really different from what I'm doing and get new ideas. Or times when I can go around down the hallway and talk to someone, spend an hour. I don't have that time anymore. Not because of...
it's been increased. Yeah. In other words, that maybe like the generation before you was doing less paperwork.
Paperwork. And they would send one grant in, be funded for 5 years, minor modifications, be funded for another 5 years. I mean, now I probably have to write one grant, make sure I write a couple of others, sent to other places just to make sure I get the funding. And then, so it's cutting back on the creative time. It's cutting back on what I propose in my grants in terms of creativity, which is a point you brought up.
Mm-hmm.
The peer review system is really suffering from mediocrity at this point in time.
And
that's scary.
And that's what I'm going to come back to. You kind of suggested in a way that that's still the one thing you want to see kept in place. In other words, that convincing that there has to be a kind of working of it, but to convince the general public, the taxpayer, that yes, okay, that's an epidemiological study. It's clear cut about its health benefits or payoff. But you've got to trust us we'll finally kind of come forward and admit there's no direct correlation, but still it's it's difficult for the non-professional or the untrained person to do that.
I would still submit that the untrained professional should not evaluate even the epidemiologic grant, but I think the untrained professional will see the relevance of the epidemiologic grant. What I'm saying is the unprofessional should also accept the benefits, although they're going to be much more long-term, towards the health of the nation and its economy, of the purely basic research proposal.
Perhaps
in both cases, I think it should be peers who review the merits of the proposal.
I don't think that, people who collect garbage should be reviewing R01 grants, and I don't know that people who get R01 grants should be
telling people who collect garbage how to
do it.
Do that. Yeah. Either. Let's stop the tape for a second. I mean, go on.